Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia and Focus newsletter. It's been more than 30 years since the five Central Asian states became independent, yet the term Russia's backyard is often still used by some people, including Western media, when reporting on the Central Asian region. Understandably, many in Central Asia find this way of describing their region offensive. Yet Russia remains a neighbor and a country with unique influence in Central Asia. How far has Central Asia come in being independent from Russia, and what are some of the ties that still bind the region to its former colonizer? To discuss all this, I am joined by Johan Engvall, an analyst at Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies, which is based at the Swedish Institute of International Affairs. And I'll mention here, too, at the start that Johan is also the author of a book on Kyrgyzstan titled The State as Investment Market, which I happen to have an autographed copy of. Thank you very much. Navbahar Imamova, veteran correspondent for Uzbek Service at Voice of America, and Timur Umarov, a fellow at Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center in Berlin. Thank you all for joining me. Navbahar, let me start with you. Russia's backyard. What's wrong with this term? What is it that when you hear that term, what's your response?
Well, hello, everyone. Always happy to be on your program, Bruce, and honored to be in the company of such brilliant experts. So happy. As you know, my views do not represent Voice of America. I'm here to share my findings as a reporter and my observations both in Central Asia and in the West. You know, people don't often remember what they hear and what they see, but they will never forget how you make them feel. So the feelings toward Russia or the discussion of Russia is really one of those moments when your country, your region is described by strangers, let's say by the foreign media, as someone else's backyard, and especially of a stronger country with an oppressive colonial history like that of Russia, many simply hate the sound of it. And, you know, I especially lately hear that a lot. They question the West. They say, okay, if you respect us, if you want to see us as independent as you claim us to be and support our sovereignty and territorial integrity, why are you defining us that way? They don't necessarily see the difference between what the foreign media say and what the foreign governments claim. So they kind of mix it together and they question this attitude. So the semantics here really matter. They touch the nerve. But if you are also to passionately argue then, Bruce, about how independent and sovereign your nation is, then you must also present an alternative picture, a vision about where things are headed. And by this, I'm really addressing the leaderships, in the region. There, I observe that they really fail at this. Presidents constantly give speeches urging people to be the kind of patriots their country need and, support their reforms, their agenda, to believe in this great future they're promising. They try to make cases that they're leading their people towards a just and prosperous society without really under, the kind of societies that are truly independent and are not considered to be by anybody's assets or backyard. But they almost never discuss the challenges. And because the challenges are not discussed openly, especially, let's say, the pressure by the Kremlin, people are left to make their own analysis and conclusions. So, for that to happen, obviously, Central Asian presidents must express critical views of Moscow that they try not to. They need to disclose some of the, pressures they face from the Kremlin and be able to answer the questions from the public, basically openly discuss your relationship with Russia, which, as we observe, none of the states, none of the governments in Central Asia want to. And since they avoid confronting media, as we know, and governments are constantly trying to dismantle any, critical voices, it's hard. So, for the region to be able to really see itself as independent and free, it needs those kinds of leaders. We see that more clearly now. Presidents who truly represent that spirit that, hey, we're not a Russian backyard. We're nobody's vassal. We are truly independent. Otherwise, I'm afraid that cynicism about these leaders being the extensions of the Kremlin will remain widespread. And We're yet to hear a compelling argument from a leader in the region, Bruce, about why his country is not a Russian backyard. As much as the public sort of disdains and resents this kind of, definition by the outsiders, it's true we see more confident governments, more assertive leaderships, proactive diplomacy. These states are better at gauging now, strategizing, balancing. And when they speak up, actually, they seem to have gotten better at explaining their policies, and they will claim that they're open to work with everyone. But and I would also add that despite living under these, authoritarian regimes, lacking free media and vibrant civil society, Central Asia is quite varied when it comes to perspectives and outlooks. The region, I would argue, is more connected to the world than ever. It's increasingly global, increasingly Islamic, increasingly polarized. Despite these assorted, outlooks, there is also a shaping public discourse on pressing issues. There is a court of public opinion that is slowly shaping. There you have some vigorous discussions, at least on social media and on some, on few journalism platforms about the way things are headed. And I'll go back to my initial point that Central Asians today care more about how they feel than what others say about them. I mean, something that I, as a reporter, consider to be a progress. The governments may be wasting millions of dollars, to promote the country's images, but many do realize today in the region that unless the reality changes on the ground, that paid publicity doesn't deliver anything substantive. So, and I will also add that the war on, in Ukraine has been a reality check on Russia. I mean, we can, go deeper in this, but I'll stop here. I'm just, by saying that the response to this, Russia, Central Asia being Russia's backyard is really nuanced and it's very complex. So we can't really, I'm not going to say that people hate and love these, Russia in general, but the attitudes are really colorful and diverse.
Okay, thank you. And we are going to get to some of those other topics about Russian ties in just a minute too, but I want to go to Johan here for a second. Johan, recently in one of your works, your papers, you'd mentioned that there's also a generational aspect at play in this too, that now we are 32 years past of independence. There's a huge section of these populations that have never lived under the Soviet Union or don't remember what that was like. How much of a factor is that in the decoupling from Russia?
Yeah, thanks. And thank you for the invitation to the show. I'm really appreciating it. Yeah, I mean, this is something that I think you have to also consider, how these societies are changing. There are several factors, I think, that contributes here. I mean, first of all, it's, as you mentioned, 22 years now that has passed since these countries became independent. Yeah. And in a way, you can say there that, after 70 years of, uniformity under the Soviet rule, they are really becoming themselves in that sense. They find their own, political path, but also, develop their distinct national identities and try to protect their sovereignty. So you also see that in this sense, the Russian culture has lost its former dominant role here in the region, even if it's still there. But then I think that you also see that things are changing, even though I wouldn't say that maybe Russian aggression against Ukraine has maybe not dramatically or abruptly shifted the relationship between the Central Asian states and Russia. But it is rather, I think, accelerated these long-term trends that we have seen. And it's also been given some impetus here to at least some cautious re-examination here of the colonial legacy in Central Asia as well. We see that wider sections of the public now even discussing this, even in countries like Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, which had never really paid attention to this or built their state on any kind of anti-colonial foundation. And you also see it in Uzbekistan. President Mirziyoyev is increasingly vocal in a way, or mentioning the injustices suffered by the Uzbek people during the Soviet era, for instance. But to come back to this that you mentioned, I think that this generational shift is really a thread running through these changes here. I mean, the region is going through very rapid societal and demographic changes, and that also, of course, has a strong impact on identity formation. And we should also remember that compared to many other of these regions or countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union, the population here in Central Asia is much younger. More than 70% of the population is under 40 years of age. So you have this large post-Soviet generation without really actual personal experience here of the Soviet Union that are now emerging on a broader front. And of course, this generation then has been shaped by development since independence, and they are, of course, changing these countries both politically and culturally. And I think this generation, especially among lower and middle classes, is also, you can see, more nationalist than previous generations. And with that, I think also comes this, you know, aspects of, you know, you try to rediscover your history and traditions and things like that. So I think that for them, you know, things that were taboo for their parents that were raised in the Soviet system, it will be natural here. So I would say that, and the relation, of course, Russia still has influence on this, but I think that Russia's appeal here now is among younger generation is less ideological and or sentimental, for that matter. But it's more related, I think, to Russia's, you know, Russia seen as maybe a source of employment or, you know, a source of material opportunities and things like that. So there are changing aspects here very much. But and of course, Russia is hypersensitive about these developments and of course, constantly takes steps to try to reverse or sabotage these processes. But maybe we'll come to that later. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. Timur, let me bring you in here. And I want to continue a little bit about this colonial discussion. First of all, what I want to ask you is, what's your sense of who's discussing this? I mean, where is this debate being had among Central Asian societies and the governments? And why am I posing the question like this? Because, I mean, I've seen some people argue that this debate about the colonial history in Central Asia is mostly being carried on by the educated elite and younger people. Is that your sense of what's going on? And also, past that, you know, what does it say about some of the government responses that are still kind of muted? The Kazakh government will acknowledge the famine of the early 1930s without specifically mentioning Russia. Uzbek President Mirziyoyev, of course, has done much to rehabilitate the jihadists and the Basmachi without actually mentioning Russia. So if you can kind of take it both those things, at what level of society is the colonial history being revisited in Central Asia? And then what about the government's actions, which show that they're also dealing with the colonial legacy of the country, but without mentioning Russia?
Yes, Bruce, thank you for having me. I think the way Central Asian countries became independent didn't leave a space for the first generation of political elites and political leaderships in all five Central Asian countries to take decolonial discourse as the main basis of their legitimacy. And because of that, and also because all of those new leaders in independent countries were basically, you know, the people who were in power during Soviet times, and all of them were Soviet people, I think for them, it was kind of difficult to talk about decolonial narratives as if it will be something that will collect a lot of popularity around their personas. That is why I think in the first two decades, we've been observing mostly continuation of Soviet tools being implemented in national building or in language policies or, you know, anything related to the ideology would remind very much Soviet techniques, with some adjustments that have been made by the leaders. And of course, the situation differed from one country to another. I think Uzbekistan stand out of the picture in a way. Uzbekistan dealt with the language policy and got rid of Cyrillic alphabet right away, and started to seek for new sources of identity for the population, but the majority of political elites were basically continuing what they were used to during Soviet times. And at the moment, we are living in a time where we have the second generation of political leadership coming to power in Central Asian countries. Although in Turkmenistan, for example, this process happened earlier with Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov coming to power more than 15 years ago. And he was already the person who didn't start his political career during Soviet times, but already did it in the independent times. In Kyrgyzstan, Sadr Japarov is the first one who also became politician in already independent Kyrgyzstan. In Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, we still have politicians as a rulers who have been around since Soviet times, but unlike their predecessors, unlike Nazarbayev and Karimov, they were not on the top of the hierarchy. And because of that, these are different people and they see the opportunities to get popularity among the society and they see different sources for it. That is why they're not against of using decolonial narratives to base their own legitimacy upon it. And especially right now when we are living in time where Russia is trying to go back in time and say that actually Soviet Union was a great entity and we should not remember Soviet times as something colonial or something that is evil, but we should look at it as a kind of role model. Of course, when you live in this narrative and when you live with a neighbor who wants to put everything on pause and kind of make you degrade in a way that you will be forever stuck in Soviet Union, the politicians understand that decolonial narratives will find people who will find it attractive, and that is why they use it. So I would say it's both. On the one hand, this is something that is more natural for the exact political leaderships in different Central Asian countries. And at the same time, this is a pragmatic way to be relevant.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I'll ask this question for all of you, but I'll start with Johan. Which of the five Central Asian countries do you think has been most successful at moving, distancing themselves from Russia since Russia launched its full-scale war in Ukraine?
Oh, difficult question. maybe I would say probably in a way, Turkmenistan is always on the side. So there you can, it's difficult to even count them. But I would say it probably is in a different ways, probably between Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. Of course, they are the strongest states here. They have emerged really as more of what's called middle powers here, in a way, the regional powers within the region. So of course, they have better abilities in a way. But on the other hand, they are also, of course, the most important. So they are often also coming under most pressure also in a way from Russia. But I would say that, you know, in a way, the most surprising, I would say, is the strong position of Kazakhstan, in a sense, which not least seen in light of the unrest there in 2022, just before there in January, with the employment of the CSTO and so. But So considering that, I would say that the quite clear stance here from Kazakhstan has been standing out in a sense. I remember, for instance, in St. Petersburg there when last year, when President Tokayev even said to a Russian audience there that Kazakhstan will not recognize you know, fake states in eastern Ukraine here. So, and I think this is the only case of a leader in the region, but also if you look a little bit wider here, saying this in Putin's presence here. And you can also see that Uzbekistan was quite early also defending Ukraine's right to its territory, including Crimea and all that. But you can see, of course, that as a result of this disapproval, if you want, of the war here from Kazakhstan's side, it's also been the target of repeated here, say, outbursts from Russian politicians, journalists, various kind of commentators in the media there, although not from the official Kremlin, but still from these really, you know, questioning Kazakhstan's right to the northern parts of the country and things like that. So a media campaign here you can talk about that puts it, of course, in an uncomfortable spot. But still, you can also see the all of these activities that Tokayev have been very active in both when it comes to the economic initiatives, both old and new, that are now really coming out here from Kazakhstan, for instance, to try to diversify and really building relations with other actors here. So I would say that in that sense, Kazakhstan has been maybe the most profiled in a way, while Uzbekistan, they are doing it maybe in a more muted way, but are still, at least privately, very clear what they think about the situation, what Russia is doing in Ukraine, I would say.
Okay, great. Thank you. Dabahar, I'll give the question to you, the same question to you. And I noticed, I remember you mentioned in your article that Tokayev, of course, had spoken Kazakh when during Putin's most recent visit. And we all saw the videos of Putin's officials scrambling for their headsets so they could get the translation. Was that really an act of independence on the part of Tokayev, a message?
Well, it was definitely seen as a daring step. That is for sure. I mean, I agree with Johan. You know, all eyes have been on Kazakhstan because Kazakhstan is Russia's immediate neighbor. It has the longest border. It has a large, Russian-speaking population. So its actions has been analyzed from a very, you know, unique perspective. And I think Uzbeks would also claim that they've been more daring because, you know, Moscow has not been able to convince them to join, to become the permanent and members of its led blocs, right? The Eurasian Economic Union and then the CSTO. So I think you have Astana and Tashkent both trying their best to speak up when it comes to the Russian pressure. But I think it's, again, it's more nuanced. And I want to go back to what you asked from Timur earlier to respond to this question as well, that, you know, Central Asian states, just like other former Soviet parts, are more aware of Russia's strength and weaknesses, you know, the extent of its military might and economic might, which sometimes they find actually relieving, you know. They have a better understanding of how Russia works, how its blocs work, for example. And then there is this anti-Russian sentiment, anti-Kremlin sentiment on the rise, not just in among the people, but within the political establishments as well. And in many ways, the way these governments have been responding do represent the public views, you know, whether they really take into account the public opinion or not. That's a different matter to discuss. But you will find enough Ukraine supporters, you will find enough Russian supporters, you'll find enough pro-Russians and pro-Westerns within the political establishment. So, you know, they're not, the ruling elite is kind of quite, you know, diverse, as I said earlier, when it comes to the discussions of Russia. But I find that there are roughly four schools of thought towards Russia, even within the political establishments, when you really kind of dive in deeper. So, you know, there's this first group that basically says, we're not Russia's backyard or its subject in any way, but we can't change the geography, and whether we like it or not, we gotta be friends with Russia. We will be an ally of Russia on mutual interests, and we don't apologize for that. They favor transactional relationships with Moscow. They believe that their country, can have balanced and strong relationships both with Moscow and other, you know, major players. And I've even heard this from some in Tajikistan and Turkmenistan, that their countries can handle those kinds of relationships. And some in this contingent also argue that everything that makes their country dependent on Russia also makes Russia dependent on them, which is also an interesting, you know, argument that they see this mutual leverage, you know, starting from the security relationship all the way to education. For them, Russia needs Central Asia as much, you know, to prosper and to overcome its current challenges as an isolated system because of the war in Ukraine. And then there is the second school of thought vis-a-vis Russia, which insists that it is time to stop calling Russia a brother. They really resent that notion. They think that it is time to live off the Soviet legacy and push back aggressively and when necessary against the Kremlin control, you know, through political channels, economic and cultural means. They say, and those were the ones who were really cheering Takayev recently when he was speaking in Kazakh, although briefly, you know, in the presence of Russian delegation, they say, let's be proud Kazakhs and Uzbeks, and let's be proud, you know, Kyrgyz and Tajik and Turkmen, you know, with Russia instead of still trying to be a Russia-influenced Central Asians. This group also, you know, sees current leaderships as Moscow's extensions. And so it's also quite a colorful group. And they see, despite the recent assertions, of course, and notable courage to push back from Takayev and, you know, sometimes from Mirziyoyev, even from Rahmon, they see current presidents in Central Asia as admiring Putin and following what they call his political, you know, technology, controlling media, using media for its, you know, for their state propaganda. I would also put reform-minded Central Asians into this contingent who advocate that real reforms is a way to overcome Russian pressure. But at the same time, real reforms could really scare Russia and position Russia against them. Then there is this, you know, third school of thought, which is even more pragmatic and realistic, I would say, than the first one. People in this group do not believe that the region is capable of moving away from Russia. That impossible politically, economically, and culturally. And, you know, see what happened in Ukraine, they ask. And they also say, why? Why should we really distance ourselves from Russia? We don't have to. And I have heard this from, you know, both Kazakh and Uzbek and Kyrgyz officials. They see that this even notion, you know, Central Asia being a Russian backyard is nonsense. Who cares? You know, they say we're inseparable anyways, even when the leaders change. They see the ties as resilient and sturdy and multi faceted. And this group also includes people who are against liberal democracy ideas and democratic reforms. Then we have the fourth group who simply do not have strong feelings towards Russia. These people don't love or hate Russia, as I said earlier. They don't know much about Russia, and other than just basic facts. For them, not knowing Russian as a language is normal. Russian is just foreign for them. And many in this group, I would say, include that majority that Johan also mentioned earlier. Year, the majority under the age of 40 in the region, they don't relate to Russia from a historic perspective or educational. This is truly a post-independent generation. And I've heard people with these kind of attitudes and perspectives in every field, in the government, in NGOs, businesses, people, you know, representing different sectors. Some are just ordinary folks, professionals, religious Central Asians, liberals, conservatives. Overall, I would say the discussion of Russia is more relaxed now in the region than before. I would also argue that critical views are more tolerated relatively. And then this decolonization discussion, which is slowly brewing, is really interesting. And I've seen that even in schools, you know, for example, in Uzbekistan, that people are more comfortable discussing their attitudes and anti-Russian sentiments, for example.
Okay, thank you. Timur, I want to give you a chance to respond to this too, but I'm also curious about, you know, Johan had mentioned Turkmenistan right at the start, and you don't usually think of Turkmenistan when you're thinking of who's propped up their own sovereignty and independence after Russia started this war in Ukraine. But you know, Turkmenistan, maybe just because it was isolationist, actually is kind of developing partnerships with Turkey and with other countries at the moment that it wasn't developing before. So what do you think? Who's been most effective at solidifying their sovereignty since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine?
I would rather turn this question to a different direction. I think different countries are in different situation when it comes to pressure from Russia or when it comes to their relationship with the Moscow and with the Kremlin. And because of the different situations that they are in, they act differently. I mean, in all countries throughout the world, the political elites, whether it's, democracy or autocratic political regime, elites want, to preserve their privileged positions in the societies. And Central Asia is not an exception. These countries and political groups inside them want, to preserve their stability of their regimes, and that is why they understand that for reaching that, on the one hand, they need to have good relationship with Russia, which will not be a relationship where Russia is dominant in every single sphere and you're super dependent. For that, you need diversified ties with the outside world, except for Russia, whether it's China, Turkey, the Gulf states, or the West collectively. Every country realizes that its position is different. So Kazakhstan's position is unique. It stands out because of the border that it has with Russia, because of the ethnic Russians that are living on the northern part of Kazakhstan, because of this neighborhood. It just becomes very, very dangerous with years. Russia has proved already for the third time how it can be aggressive towards its neighbor when it doesn't like the neighbor's domestic politics. And because of that, Kazakhstan, simply cannot approve of what Russia is doing, because automatically it will mean that Kazakhstan might theoretically approve anything that Russia might in the future do towards its own sovereignty. And because of that, I think Kazakhstan tries very hard to make it clear that Kazakhstan is not supporting Russia's aggression, and even tries to criticize it in a way. Other countries feel more relaxed in a way, but also the history of how they developed in the independent period set different limits to Russia's presence there. For example, Turkmenistan, as you rightly said, from the very beginning was very isolated. It's really a North Korea in Central Asia without a nuclear bomb. And because of that, they really cut off all of the, potential influences of outside players inside the country, so that the government has a full control of what kind of information people consume and with whom they talk and who comes to the country and what companies operating, what organizations are welcomed and which organizations are not welcomed. And this neutrality, on the one hand, allowed the regime to keep the control over the society, but at the same time, it allowed to have this distance with Russia and together with Russia, with many other countries around the world. Uzbekistan was also situated comfortably inside Central Asia, in the very center of it, without a mutual border with Russia, which gave Uzbekistan from the very beginning a kind of more freedom of maneuver, unlike Kazakhstan would have. That is why Uzbekistan today is not part of Russia's integration projects, or it cannot be perceived as Russia's greatest ally, considering how bumpy the relationship were in the last three decades. So it gave Uzbekistan, and continues to give to even today, more freedom when it comes to relationship with Russia. So I would rather say that everyone has their own situation, and because of that, everyone acts differently. But what unites everybody is that everybody is pragmatic and everybody wants the best for themselves.
Great. Thank you. A reminder, we're talking about the use of the term Russia's backyard, and we're looking at how the Central Asian states are or are not close and dependent upon Russia in the wake of Russia's invasion, full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And my guests are Nabahar Imamova, veteran correspondent for the Uzbek service at Voice of America, Timur Umarov, a fellow at the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center in Berlin, and Johan Engvall, an analyst at the Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies, which is based at the Swedish Institute of International Affairs. Timur, I'm going to come back to you. You know, you've been very objective in your papers on Russian Central Asian relations, and you brought up the fact that actually Russia's paying more attention to Central Asia than they ever have, than certainly in the years since the Soviet Union fell apart, and that there are some aspects of Russia that will always remain. But could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, Russia's really made a big effort to try to up its, if not influence, certainly its presence in Central Asia since February 2022.
Yes, definitely. I think what has changed in the last couple of years amidst the war in Ukraine is Russia's position around the world and Russia's position in Central Asia as a part of the world where Russia is present very actively and in many different dimensions. But what changed is that Moscow is no longer welcomed in many places where it was welcomed before, and you know, it doesn't really have a lot of places where its president can visit, or the regions that are welcoming Russia's investment or having continuing their normal trade relationship, business relationship. And Central Asia here would be this particular part of the world that continues to be there and didn't turn its back on Russia. And in a way, for Russia, there are not many options on the table. And that is why I think those resources, the energy that Russia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs has, the businesses capacity to go abroad, they are in the last 2 years have been focusing on the regions that are still available. And we see how the politicians are visiting Central Asian countries from Russia. We see how businesses are thinking about opening, or some of them are opening their offices in Central Asia. And this is a process that, you know, will not stop in the nearest future, considering that, you know, the sanctions are here to stay. Apart from that, for the first time in history, we saw a migration wave from Russia to Central Asia, which actually also leads to a more closed ties between the societies of Central Asian countries and Russia, even though this flow of migrants it didn't consist of people who support what Russia is doing or disapprove of Russia's policies. But they are still representatives of the Russian societies, and with this experience and with these new connections that they created and with this new knowledge, I think they also contribute to the future of the relationship between Central Asian states and Russia. And, you know, also inside Russia, I think a lot of attention right now is being paid to Central Asia, considering that whether inside of Russia you have those groups that are pro-war or against the war, everyone tries to find examples of that will kind of help them support their argument, saying that Russia's foreign policy is being welcomed around the world or not being welcomed, and because of that, they pick and choose different examples that are coming from Central Asia. And also, you know, overall, people in Russia who still living in a times where there is a risk of potential mobilization. They right now, I think, have Central Asia as a potential plan B for their future. So in a way, we've seen how Central Asia, you know, with the war in Ukraine, alienated from Russia, but at the same time, we see how on different spheres. The region and Russia have become closer. So everything is much more nuanced and, you know, not black and white as it might seem on the surface.
Hey, great. Thank you. Nabahar, Uzbekistan, we've talked about them distancing themselves somewhat from Russia. But at the same time, of course, early on in Mirziyoyev's presidency, he arranged a deal that Uzbekistan is importing Russian oil. They recently, this year, started importing Russian natural gas, which never happened before. And Russia, certainly Rosatom, is making a huge pitch for Uzbekistan to use their services to build the nuclear power plant. One could argue that Russia has more influence in Uzbekistan now than it did just a couple of years ago. What are your thoughts on that?
It does. It does. And you actually, despite the fact that Tashkent, you know, denies this, Russia hand is still, stronger when it comes, especially to the energy sector. Right now, we have another energy crisis brewing across Uzbekistan, and of course, you know, the Mirziyoyev administration will deny that this is a crisis. Last year, it quietly, I would say, blamed the Kremlin for the difficulties, energy, you know, shortages in the country. I remember trying to push Uzbek officials to talk about this, and they were, you know, privately saying that it's all Russian pressure. It's Russia is playing games with us. You know, Russia is really pushing us to this into this crisis. But then, as we know, the energy ministry, the Uzbek government made new deals with Russia. And this year was expected to be easier than before. But so far, I mean, the news hasn't been that good. And you have many, many Uzbeks asking every day, you know, specifically on social media, where is that gas that we've been, you know, we should be buying through Kazakhstan? Where is it going? And how come we are still, you know, struggling with shortages? So I think here, I mean, the Mirziyoyev administration has a lot of work to do in terms of communicating what it is doing with Russia, you know, when it comes to energy issues to its own people. And of course, to clarify so many other, you know, questions that pertain to the relationship. Another interesting factor that I hear, of course, this can also be argued as a mutual leverage. As I mentioned earlier, there's definitely a strong long-term link with Russia that people see, through labor migration, businesses, and also increasing Muslim population, this new generation of Central Asians in Russia. And many Uzbeks relate to Russia through that prism, especially labor migration. Every second or third household, I would argue, has a relationship with Russia. The government realizes this more than ever. Their livelihoods depend on this country. So when you discuss these issues, so many critical economic, factors are mentioned by just the ordinary folks. Even, I mean, I was having this conversation this summer in Rishton, in Fergana, at a local bazaar, where people seemed to be happy with their, you know, summer harvest, and everything was going well as far as they were telling me. But when I was asking, some questions about how, like, let's say there are lots of constructions around Uzbekistan. People have more cars now. People have more property. And I'm always questioning, like, where is this revenue from? You know, where are you getting this money to build this new, you know, bungalow? And it's usually you hear the word Russia. Russia is a very important factor in Uzbekistan. And people wish that there were more open conversations about this, but I would also argue that the discourse is more relaxed now. I mean, people do discuss these issues, even, you know, whether government likes it or not. And remember how in the earlier days of the Russian invasion, Bruce, we saw the Uzbek government and other neighboring countries also trying to censor, you know, restrict the coverage of the war and analysis of the Russian aggression and, you know, the international, specifically Western response to it. I heard many officials then, you know, in Tashkent specifically, I was there, who said, why should we jeopardize our relationship with Moscow? This is a critical relationship. This is not our war. We don't have to rush to express ourselves or pick a lane or even frame a narrative about the war, about the, you know, invasion of Ukraine. We just watch and what happens. They were that, you know, they were being that careful. They're not as nervous anymore, as I find. And the media in Uzbekistan, and I would also argue across the region, are not necessarily actively covering the war, but they're not ignoring it either. I mean, I have live hits with Uzbek news outlets, you know, at least a couple of times a month discussing Ukraine. I mean, Zelensky's visit to Washington recently, American aid to Ukraine. I mean, these are being discussed in the Uzbek media, and they're more, I would say, you know, comfortable. But it's true, and it continues, that the Uzbek government uses Russian pressure as a great excuse, I would say, to be, you know, heavy-handed sometimes, or to justify systemic problems such as energy shortage. But their main concern, as Timur also mentioned earlier, is internal. And this is not just about Uzbekistan. The top priority, I would argue, in the region is ensuring that for the governments, for the leaderships, is ensuring the safety and security of the regime and the ruling elite, which is, you know, which has strong links with Russia. This is why they don't allow political opposition, real political opposition, to have strong opponents, means to be overthrown from power for them. I mean, that's how they see this. So I would say the domestic dissent is what they fear most, despite the fact that they attribute a lot of problems to the Russian pressure.
Okay, thank you. Johan, could you talk a little bit about the role of migrant laborers? We just heard that mentioned, and how important that is in the Russian-Central Asian relationship. And then I noticed in your article, too, that you'd mentioned Russia's expansion of schooling program in Central Asia, too, trying to get more Russian language schools open in Central Asia wherever they can. So could you talk about the role of migrant laborers and Russia's efforts to open more Russian schools in Central Asia, please?
Sure, thanks. I mean, labor migrants, that of course, they are an extremely vulnerable group, but also then, of course, very important for the home countries here. I mean, you only have to look at the statistics there, with remittances corresponding to, you know, a third of Kyrgyzstan's and almost a third of Kyrgyzstan's and Tajikistan's GDP, and maybe 10% of Uzbekistan's, because there's, even if Uzbekistan has the most labor migrants, they have a stronger own economy. So the share is smaller then, but still, I mean, maybe 4 or 5 million people, that's a lot. And of course, then when the full-scale invasion of Ukraine broke out and these sanctions were imposed on the Russian economy, the immediate forecast was, of course, that many of these Central Asian labor migrants would have to return home. And then with all this risk of, you know, of course, increased unemployment, declining remittances, and the risk of social unrest. But despite these growing challenges that they confront, of course, in Russia, and it was also the fact that the Russian economy has held up much better, actually, than expected, and because of the sanctions, and resisted them. Central Asian workers have continued to arrive in Russia. And you can maybe also say that because of the war and the mobilization you have seen, Russia's own labor is shrinking quite dramatically, and that might even further reinforce the need for labor migrants to fill this shortage. So, of course, this continues to make the Central Asian states very vulnerable to Russian threats here all the time, of maybe sending them home. But also, of course, from the laborers' perspective, they are, of course, in a very difficult situation, also being pressured, threatened, tricked by Russian officials here to join the war, or being promised citizenships or other benefits, things like that. So this is, of course, a very delicate issue when you think about it. And of course, maybe also this, when it comes to trade, maybe add also there, you see that, of course, this, despite this, you know, we also thought that the trade relations would suffer here between the Central Asian states and Russia, but they have actually also been growing since the full-scale invasion. And of course, here maybe we should also address the sanctions issue, which is becoming more and more a discussion here in Europe, for instance, and Central Asia's role in helping Russia to evade sanctions. And of course, we see on the statistics that Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan particularly, there have been a sharp increase here in exports to these countries from cars and car parts and, you know, laundry machines, different household products and all that, that are then assumingly being re-exported to Russia. And this, of course, this is a serious issue, of course. But what I hear from Europe in this sense, there are, I mean, attempts to maybe single out these Central Asian countries, making them some kind of scapegoats here. When I would say that the even bigger problem, or at least the place to start at, would be for countries like, you know, Germany or Sweden, for that matter, to get their own export control in order. Because, of course, in countries like this, Kyrgyzstan, with a rather rough capitalist system and problems with corruption and all that, of course, there will always be creative and opportunistic businessmen or, you know, people in general taking advantage of these opportunities. So I think that, but this is also factor that I think really is for the governments here, this is something that we probably have to look closer at. This is putting them in a even tougher spot, I think. And depending on which step they take when it comes to, you know, this circumventing of sanctions, there can be a trigger, a strong response from either Russia or the West. So, yeah. And then, of course, this with the Russia's counter, in a way, with the promoting Russian schools and in Central Asia. I mean, you can say that, as I mentioned, of course, Russia. I would say that there are two main factors that I can look at really when Russia here from a more, you know, soft power point of view, if you look from this more cultural perspective, of course, that can be used to continue to control these countries. And of course, the Russian media is the main one, I would say, tool here for shaping public opinion in Central Asia. And they are, of course, very effective here in hammering in different messages here of, you know, portraying the West as evil and Ukraine as a Nazi state, but also to try to portray these countries as you know, extensions of the Russian world, that they share some values and norms here with them. And the other aspect is, of course, and that's connected to that, of course, is the lingering role here still of the Russian language, which underpins the influence here. And of course, Russia views any attempt to, how to say, downgrade the Russian language as an unfriendly act. And you see this in this context. Rossatrudnicheystvo is the main organization here to fund, you know, Russian cultural influence abroad, and especially then fund modern Russian schools and other institutions that to ensure that the Russian culture maintain its presence here. And and one aspect that was communicated quite recently was that in Kyrgyzstan was announced here that new modern top-notch Russian language schools will be financed here by Russia in all of the seven regions of the country, but also in the major cities here, Bishkek and Osh. So this is, of course, you see this through this soft power also tools that they try to in a way arrest this development and ensure that, you know, the continued importance here of Russian culture and language in this sense.
Okay, great. We're coming close to the end. And in fact, we've probably already gone long, but I want to give everyone a chance. If you could, in 2 minutes, tell me, what do you think the audience, people listening, need to know about how Russia's relationship with Central Asia has changed since the war in Ukraine started, since Russia launched its full-scale war on Ukraine in February, late February 2022? Johann, I'll go to you first. 2 minutes. What are the big change people need to know? What's happening there?
Maybe not so much change as a message, I would say, that these countries are, you know, that's been clear, that they are no satellites to Russia. They are seeking their own agency here. Among all these states, we have seen a lot of activity when it comes to new diplomatic security policy, new economic initiatives aimed at really balancing this dependence on Russia for the purpose of protecting their own interests here. And I think that none of this would have been possible actually without the previous attempts also, the conscious ones here to actually pursue this so-called multi-vector foreign policy, which has in this sense provided a useful base here. This is not something that has emerged with this war that they tried to, they have something to build on here. And I mean, already in 1997, Tokayev back then published a book where he actually laid out this concept of what he called a positive balance, also balancing these close relations with Russia by building close relations with China, as well as the US and Europe. Now we see, we have heard before also here, we see the Gulf countries are also part of this. Turkey, of course, expanding its influence even here, apart from not to speak of South Caucasus. So you see this, that they have managed to still lay the foundation here for themselves to actually have some own room for action here in a very difficult geopolitical situation. So I think that would definitely not have been possible if they were Russian satellites, as you often hear, or Russia's backyard, just as you often hear in Western media. Then, thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you. Nalbahar, what's changed in the last about nearly 2 years in Russian Central Asian relations?
You know, Bruce, ironically, because of the war in Ukraine, because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Central Asian states seem more confident, are more assertive, and are more united than ever. So that is, I would argue, the main outcome so far, the impact, the result so far. These countries want to be seen as normal states dealing with normal challenges. And, you know, they resent being featured as a struggling former Soviet country, as a region stuck between major powers. But on the other hand, to their own people, these leaders, these governments describe their systems and challenges as exceptional, you know, requiring extraordinary policies and steps that actually serve to defend their autocratic and nepotistic actions, as we see, you know, today, tight control over citizens and media, for example. But over the last year or so, I've also been hearing from Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and Uzbek that they deserve a certain kind of appreciation for being a security link that they are regionally. They see themselves as such. You know, these voices also say that the region is managing the fallout from the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, is dealing with a lot of issues, international issues, and they have been absorbing Russians fleeing the conscription. And so, you know, they feel like they deserve some credit for that. As we know, they have sought the American and the European support to sort of like stymie, you know, regional issues. But they do want to be respected as independent nations, and they don't want to be treated as or seen as small countries under the Russian shadow, or, you know, governments dreading angry Russia, even though privately sometimes we hear them saying that to the Americans and the Europeans. You know, they, again, in these interactions, they use Russian pressure as a way to get to their goals a lot.
Great, thank you. And that brings us to you, Timur. What's the big change in the last 22 months in Russian Central Asian ties?
I would say, for me, what I see have changed in the relationship between Russia and Central Asia is the way Russia looks at Central Asia. I mean, of course, it didn't change dramatically, especially when we speak about the Russian leadership. But when we speak about the society, I think many people for the first time have visited Central Asia. Many people for the first time have seen with their own eyes what Central Asia is, and that is not something that reminds, far countries like Afghanistan, but it's, the cities of Central Asia are much more similar in a way to the cities of Russia. The post-Soviet heritage is still there, although Central Asia is very different. So I think this has changed. And also the way the leadership looks at Central Asia has changed. Previously, I think the Kremlin would rather see Central Asia as a source of constant problems, and the Kremlin was not initiating any, cooperation mechanisms with the Central Asian countries, but would rather always wait for the initiative come from Central Asia. But now I think it turned upside down. I think Russia needs Central Asia, and that is why Russian, you know, president and the members of Russian Security Council are so much focused on Russia's presence in Central Asia. And from Central Asia, Russia looks as a country that brings a lot of problems to the region and to the region's relationship with other countries around the world. So now Central Asia, every time the president of a Central Asia country goes to Russia, has to think whether or not it will be perceived as a support of Russia's aggression against Ukraine, and whether or not it will somehow later echo as a secondary sanctions for their country. They have to be very careful when they deal with Russia, which was not something that countries would have dealt before the war. So I think, what's changed is the fact that Russia has become uncomfortable partner, but the partner that is at the same time needed for having this balance between many different players.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. We have come to the end of our show. So thank you, Timur, Johan, and Nabahar. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asian Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next year, actually. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.